Like a trusted turnout jacket you've had for years, Flex 7 outer shell fabric delivers a perfectly broken-in feel on the very first wear. Flexible, comfortable, and powered with the strength of Enforce technology, Flex 7 outer shell fabric is made to move. To learn more, visit tenkatafabrics.com/flex7. Flex 7, powered by Enforce technology, only from Tenkata Protective Fabrics.
Seconds count when responding to an emergency. Minutes save count when documenting your day. Emergency networking makes records management easier and faster with its fire and EMS solution. User-friendly, complete online and offline functionality, highly customizable, all at an affordable price. For more information, please visit emergencynetworking.com.
So here we are, another beautiful day in the fire service court. I wish I could be John Murphy, and I'm sure you wish you could be Brad Pinsky. Neither of which is...
I'm not sure either one of those two statements are true now.
Well, did you see my nose getting bigger?
Well, this is what's... How about this? This is what's left of fire service court on September 11th of 2023.
That's right.
The last two standing.
So here we are having another great time discussing those exciting legal topics of the day. And I'm Chip Comstock, and you are?
Kurt Varone, I think. At least I was when I woke up. But so I have a family history of Alzheimer's, so, you know, could be a problem there.
So, well, again, we're the two of us, as Kurt said, are the last two standing for today. And so we've been tasked to discuss legal issues. That's what we do. And Kurt has suggested a topic that evolves around a case in Baltimore County, Maryland. And I don't know, Kurt, if you want to do the recitation of some of the facts.
Yeah, I'm happy to. The case, it goes back to, let me get the dates correct here. Let me see here.
June of 2017 is what my... Yeah,
so it really goes back quite a ways. But the issue kind of simplified. We have a firefighter who's using a fake name, fake identity in social media, sends a message to another firefighter asking that firefighter to get nude pictures of a colleague, a female colleague. And then offers to share other pictures of other firefighters with them. That firefighter in turn informs a battalion chief, or is it a division chief, who then in turn reports it up the chain of command to the fire chief's headquarters. And about the same time, a decision is made to notify Baltimore County police department, their cyber crimes unit. So we've got a police investigation started. The fire department, I guess, doesn't start an investigation. I think that's sort of interesting question number one. I think there's good reason why, in my opinion, there's good reason why the fire department should not start an investigation at that point. But at any rate, the police department start the investigation. Takes 5 or 6 weeks or so. They identify who they believe to be the perpetrator. Apparently, they bring him in, and it appears that he admitted it. He ends up resigning. At that point, the females who are involved are informed, or somewhere in the mix there, they are informed. I'm assuming that at some point they went to an attorney, or some of the victims did, and the attorney filed a complaint with the EEOC. And again, some of this is speculation on my part, but they filed a complaint with the EEOC or the EEOC equivalent. Many states have a human relations commission that serves the role of the EEOC. And the reason why that's important is once you notify, in order to sue for sexual harassment or any sort of Title VII discrimination, under the Civil Rights Act of 1964, you have to notify the EEOC, and then they will do one of two things. They will either take the case themselves, they will investigate it, or they will refer it, but they'll give a right to sue letter, which is what you need in order to file a lawsuit for employment discrimination. So in this case, what it appears is they referred it to the U.S. attorney. The U.S. attorney said, we're interested in this. Now, it took quite a while. Obviously, this happened in 2017. But the U.S. attorney filed suit against the Baltimore County Fire Department in Baltimore County, alleging sexual harassment and discrimination against the unnamed victims of this. And I believe there was somewhere around 11. I'm not sure if that's the exact number, but somewhere around 11 females whose pictures were either obtained or sought to be obtained. And but the federal government basically said the county didn't do enough to prevent or intervene in this. And which, you know, that's not unusual that, the federal government takes the side of the victims, files the lawsuit on their behalf, so they don't have to go out and get their own attorneys. What's, I think, another unusual part of this is that the day that the lawsuit was filed, and that would have been about a week ago, I guess, they also submitted a joint settlement agreement with a consent decree indicating that Baltimore County sort of acknowledged that this happened and they're going to agree to implement certain steps to move the department forward to try to address some of the shortcomings. But one of those is that they're going to get, I guess, better at investigating. And I don't know, Chip, there's a number of parts of this that kind of leave me scratching my head. And one of them is criticism that the department didn't promptly investigate it. I don't know, you and I, we kind of just briefly kind of talked about some of the facts. We didn't get too deep into it, but do you think the department should have immediately launched its own investigation here?
Well, you know, you touched on it when you asked the question, should the department have conducted its own investigation? And I think as I read the decision, the complaint and or decision in this case or entry, the inference is that they did nothing. Now, it talks about really the period of do nothing, the period of sitting on their hands was about 2 months. And which, yeah, in the world of law, that we're just getting our coffee in that time, right? I mean, that's 60 days is nothing. I have a case that I was at this morning where we discussed setting dates and, you know, the judge met the parties and the case has been pending for over 2 years. So nothing moves quickly.
And look at this case. This case happened in 2017. It wasn't filed. It's 6 years.
Right.
So how can you say you didn't act quick enough in 60 days? But it took us 6 years. That's okay.
And then he did notify the police, right? And mm-hmm. So do I think that the city should have been conducting its own investigation at the time you had a concurrent investigation? I don't think so. Okay. So the only question is, should they have done something, you know, as soon as they found out about this, should they, I mean, the certainly the United States government seems to suggest that as soon as you became aware of this, either internally or externally, you should have done something. And whether that's within 2 weeks or 30 days, but one of the takeaways is this is 60 days, at least according to the United States government, seems to be too long.
I'm troubled by it because the allegations potentially are criminal. You've got some.
Well, I think they are.
Well, there was no criminal charges, which I also find a little troubling. But at any rate, you've got potential criminal charges. You don't know who the accused is at this point. If you start interviewing people, you can inadvertently get into a Garrity problem. So if I'm advising the Baltimore County, if they were my client, and I'm not an attorney in Maryland, so I can't speak to Maryland law, but in Rhode Island, I would not advise my clients to conduct their own investigation at this point. In fact, I don't want to interview the victims because they're victims of some sort of a sexual offense. And I don't want to put myself in a situation where I am going to somehow mess up the criminal part of this investigation. So that's my advice.
Well, there's an ongoing situation in Ohio, and it involves a client, fire department, so I don't want to get into too many of the details, but it involved an act by a potential employee that was via the internet that was anonymous. And so the first issue is, what tools or power do we have as a fire department to track that identity down, right? Because law enforcement can issue subpoenas. They can, take it through that course, working with internet providers, obtain that information to track it back to a source. Fire departments absolutely don't have that, at least as far as I know, most states don't have that ability to do that. So as you said, if we start fussing around, that creates potential issues. The other thing in cases similar to mine, maybe in this case, is ultimately the employer of the employee, i.e. the fire department, may get sued, or there may be allegations pressed against that person. So not only is the risk that we are screwing it up, but you purposely did or didn't do something as part of the investigation, or you intimidated somebody, or you treated as part of an interview process, you did or said something to a victim that was improper. So there's just so many things that can go sideways where you are a potential, I'll say, civil defendant. I think you're better off giving it to that third party to do a neutral, objective outside investigation.
Well, again, I think when you have a potential criminal victim, and that's the women in this case are the victims of a possible criminal offense. Some of these pictures, where they came from, they could have involved a romantic partner that they were with who took the pictures, or some of them may have been taken surreptitiously, whatever that may be. But my general bias, and I've never been, I was a student prosecutor in law school. I was able to get appointed as a student prosecutor, and that's really the extent of my experience as a prosecutor. But I know enough about prosecuting that when I've got a sexual victim, a victim of some sort of sexual offense, I do not want people interviewing that victim, at least until we've had the opportunity to interview them and get all of the information related to whatever offense did or did not happen. So how do you do an investigation if you can't talk to the victims and you can't talk to the perpetrator and you don't know who the perpetrator is and you don't have the in-house ability to do that? I don't know what the U.S. attorney was thinking in this case, other than, maybe wanting to make a point about sexual harassment in the workplace, which I agree with. This should not have happened. Okay. Well, but criticize the department here. I just don't feel that the department deserved to be criticized for that.
Well, again, I think it's just not the fact that they didn't do an investigation per se, because they never did an investigation. What they're criticized, I think, is not doing something within 60 days. I think you and I are in agreement that something should not have been an internal investigation. They should have referred it out right as soon as they became aware.
Well, they did. They referred it to the police, to let the police. Right. Whether you do this, if you're going to do a fire department investigation, whether you have a law firm do it for you or whether you do it yourself, the issues are the same. You have to interview the witnesses, the victims, and you also are going to have to start working your way to figure out who the accused is. And so whether a fire, let's say a deputy chief that's trained as an investigator does it, or you have an attorney, a law firm that comes in and does it, that to me, that doesn't matter. The point is that you're potentially interfering with a criminal investigation. You let the criminal investigation develop. And then when the investigators on the criminal side get to the point where they say, yeah, go ahead, you can interview the witnesses, then you can start your investigation. But I just, again, I think I just, I don't understand where the U.S. attorney, and if this is so important that you've got to file a federal case about it, why did it take you 6 years to file the case if time was so important? And I, again, I think there's a little bit of contradiction in that.
Yeah, no, I agree with everything you're saying. Again, I just look at, you know, the headings in the complaint, and again, it says, you know, failed to properly investigate the solicitation. Yeah. I don't think it's the fact that it's that they didn't do it internally. I think they viewed it as sitting on the hands. And again, the message moving forward, if anybody runs into this, is I think you and I would both advise, based on what we've talked about, to start an investigation, and you and I, our recommendation is to not do it internally because of all the issues we just...
I'm not saying that, because I'm going to tell you, I there's a big discussion that I've been involved in with a lot of different people, and there's a lot of people out there saying that we should not be doing our own investigations. I think that's a lot of bunk. We need to be doing our own investigations. Firefighters should not be interviewed by people who have no understanding of our culture, no understanding of the fire service. Firefighters should be investigated by firefighters. Okay, it's like a somebody who's got absolutely no experience in law enforcement investigating what police officers have to do. And they don't understand the pressures. They don't understand the circumstances. They've got absolutely no experience in law enforcement, and they're going to sit there and pick apart what a police officer does at a traffic stop. Baloney. I think firefighters should be the ones to be doing investigations in fire departments, with the exception where there's conflicts of interest. But I think 99% of the investigations should be done, but that also means we've got to have trained investigators in our organizations to be conducting those investigations.
Yeah, you know, again, I think I'm going to agree with you in many respects, but in others, again, I've been involved. I used to, in my old days, represent police officers in civil rights cases, and I was involved in a number of police shootings. And mm-hmm. you know, the thing that we talk about is, you know, that from a police officer standpoint, the decision that has to be made quickly, no time for second thoughts. Mm-hmm. Hindsight being 20/20, again, you have to look at the facts and circumstances. So I get all that, but in a number of the shooting cases I was involved in, you brought in outside organizations, right? Mm-hmm. And so the outside organizations were state police, county sheriffs, yeah. Bureau of Criminal Investigation, FBI,
right.
Because you didn't want to do your own investigation. I wanted somebody who's going to be outside objective that I could then take those findings to court, mm-hmm. and say, listen, this was the state police who did this. This wasn't us who did our own internal investigation. Yes, they understand that. They understand all the things that go with it. So I think you and I are, you know, we can say that fire understands fire, police understand police, but that doesn't mean that investigation from on this has to be your own fire investigation. You can go to other, you know, organizations that are fire based mm-hmm. to have them come in and assist.
Yeah, and I think that's fine, but I really think that I hear a steady drumbeat of people that haven't really thought through this issue, stating that firefighters are incapable of investigating firefighters, that any time we have an allegation, we have to go outside the organization, which I think is bunk. I really honestly do. I don't think you're going to get a better product. What we do need is we need to have investigators that are trained.
Right.
You know? And that's a shortcoming, I think. But that's for a different topic. That's for a different day.
Remember that. We'll have a good discussion on that.
Right. But I'm troubled by it. And again, I'm not saying that what happened here was okay. I'm the exact opposite, you know, that we should not be having this kind of problem in the fire service. I find it hard to believe that the perpetrator, if the perpetrator did what he is accused of having done, that there weren't other indicators about this person, that there were things that were concerning about them. And, you know, kind of forensically, you go back and look at this, probably you're going to say, yeah, we should have realized that we had a problem with this guy at this point, but we kind of missed an opportunity and we probably should have done something at this point and we missed an opportunity. So, I think we've got to get better at doing this. So I'm not saying that what was done was okay, but what I'm saying is the criticism of the department not immediately investigating this, I really think is unfortunate. I would have advised them to do the exact same thing, that we do not want to start an investigation. We don't want to tip the accused off that we're onto them. We don't want to tip off the victims prematurely. And we certainly don't want to have conversations with them until they've been interviewed by the police. And so we've got to take a backseat to the police investigation.
I think you and I are on the same page. The issue, again, because you're not going to be able to find out who this person is, the accused who's, you know, anonymous via the internet, until you track down the IP addresses, et cetera, and again, law enforcement has to do that. And yes, I think at some point you can and should do your investigation. And when we talk about the delay in investigation here again, and I know it troubles you in terms of 6 days, I think it's that, hey, if this was with all the things that we're looking at, somebody should have notified the police earlier. That's the sense I get from it.
Today, if I'm reading it correctly, they found out about it on June 26th and they notified the police on June 26th. I'm not sure what else they could have done. I mean, unless I'm missing something, and maybe the truth is I'm missing something. I don't know. I mean, you and I don't spend our lives reading these cases and digesting them. So maybe I'm missing something. If they had let this go like 6 months, 3 months, 4 months, whatever, then you're talking about a different situation. But I mean, it looks to me like the day that they found out about it is the day they notified the police.
I think I'm looking back through the dates to see if you're right, because if that's the first allegation is June 26th, they received a message from the anonymous alias screen name requesting the photographs. And so June 27th, another volunteer firefighter receives a Facebook message from the same anonymous person that had contacted the other employee the day earlier. And it says, was reported the information to the police department. So he does report the police department. And next is on or about June 30th, 2017, police department informed these employees of the messages that someone was soliciting or sending photographs of them. So it is from the first receipt, June 26th, to a notification of the victims by the police officers, it is 4 days. So that in and of itself, I agree with you in that sense. Yes, if we're looking at 4 days, that seems entirely reasonable to me. And I think you and I are on the same page that they should not have done anything in terms of the investigation. They should have notified the police. They did that timely. And so the failure to investigate or the allegations seem to be misplaced. Yes,
they do. And again, I understand they're trying to make a point, and they made the point, you know, that the department needs to be better and we all need to be better. We can all improve. But I just that criticism that they drag their feet. And again, maybe there's other things that we're not aware of, but at any rate, that's sort of kind of friction point number one for me. Friction point number two, and I kind of threw this out to you earlier. It's probably not something that firefighters are going to really be enthusiastic about our discussion, but I think as lawyers, there's a question on the U.S. Constitution. Sets up our federal court system, and federal courts are governed by Article 3 in the U.S. Constitution. And in order for a federal court to have jurisdiction, there has to be a case or controversy. And it's a very important constitutional, it goes back to Marbury versus Madison and who's going to make the decisions when, you know, people can't agree on the law. But the bottom line is there has to be a case or controversy. And when two sides to a lawsuit, okay, agree on whether there's been a violation of the law, whatever it may be, but the bottom line is they both agree, and they, to the point where the lawsuit gets filed and simultaneously a consent decree is entered, I don't see a case of controversy. And I, you know, you do a lot more litigation, you might have more experience in this, but from my perspective, I'm like, how is there a case of controversy when one side files the lawsuit and simultaneously says, yeah, and here's our settlement? There's no case of controversy.
I was a party to one of these.
In fact, now remember,
I'm in federal court.
We do them in state court. State court is different. You're not dealing with Article III.
Right. Well, you still have issues on whether, you know, the issues are moot. I mean, you still have to have a controversy to for court to decide at whatever level.
Yeah.
And the issue, it, from a practical standpoint, to answer your question, is it's only an issue if one side raises it, right? I mean, you would be, if you raise this and said, hey, we're objecting. And what happened in my case, I had a third party intervene and we had a complaint. The parties knew what the controversy was. We were able to resolve it, but we wanted to have a enforceable entry. So day one, we filed a complaint. Day two, judgment entry goes on. There's an answer and then a judgment entry. And a person appeals that. Moses files a motion to intervene and appeals this and et cetera, et cetera. And the Court of Appeals didn't take kindly from the timing. And I will tell you that it got reversed in my case. They basically said this looks like collusion. And I'll just add this little asterisk. By the time the Court of Appeals had ruled, we already got accomplished what we wanted to do. And when it reversed, I dismissed, et cetera. I think in this case, you know, in the criminal cases, again, this is a civil case, it's not a criminal case, but, you know, they enter into, you know, proffers and plea deals where there's, a, you know, they'll bypass the formal indictments, et cetera. And the person walks up and says, hey, we've reached a deal. I think that in these cases, I agree with you in theory, but in reality, unless somebody is going to say, hey, by the way, there's no controversy here. We already agreed to everything.
And a judge,
it's never going to be addressed.
A judge should be able to raise that themselves, because in order for them to hear a case,
remember, a complaint is filed and we accuse you of, you know, it's not where you just walk in and say, judge, here's our agreement, right?
That's what they did. Well,
they filed the complaint first and said, we have a disagreement. And then we have a,
and, 30 seconds later, that. 30 seconds later, we have,
yeah.
we've resolved.
I would have waited a couple of days, right? I would have waited a couple of days. It doesn't, the date stamp on here does not have a time stamp, because I would like to see if they were within 30 seconds of each other. It's like, boy, that was really quick. You know, that deal was mediated out pretty quickly. It's, you know, one of the issues I have, or, you know, they can enter into agreements that, you know, we have contracts all the time. You're going to do this. We're going to do this. This is a deal that we're agreeing to, without seeking redress in the courts. Mm-hmm. And here in the United States files a complaint to get to vote federal jurisdiction, again, whether it's proper or not, but they vote federal jurisdiction and they enter into a proposed joint. It's a joint motion for a consent decree, right? They're saying to the judge, hey, we're asking you to enter into this agreement.
because we've resolved our disagreement.
Right. But, you know, to your point, if a judge, this is a motion, the judge can look at this and reject it right off the bat. What, yeah. You know, why do I need to get involved in this? Mm-hmm. My guess is it happens a lot more than you and I, you know, understand, because I'm willing to bet that that people do this on a regular basis, dealing with the United States government, and the courts are going to review it unless there's something that's crazy about it, are likely to adopt it, at least in part. There has to be, you know, this is the kind of thing that I will say, there has to be a little bit of a delay. Kurt, this is the practical side of things, because, this is, again, this is, now I'm putting my lawyer brains on, right? So they file a case in federal court, and they file with it the attached civil cover sheet, which everybody has to do, what's the nature of this case. And then they also attach to it a summons in a civil action. Now, keep in mind, there is no waiver, right? There's no waiver of summons filed with us. Like, hey, we're going to get you signed this. We're going to file suit. Please waive summons. So this case wouldn't even, by time, my guess is, unless, again, the clerk's office was able to run right out and serve somebody, there's no service on the defendant in this case, right? And what only suggests is how fast this had to have taken place. When this is filed with the court, there is, you don't know who, it's all, most courthouses, it's, there's multiple federal judges, so you don't know who you're going to get, right? It's a random draw. So when they file this, it's civil action blank, and it's, you know, jury trial set forth, which is kind of, You're asking for a jury trial on this when you should already know that you've got this deal done, and then you don't have the judge's name on here, but the joint motion for consent decree does at the end of this have the signature provision for the judge. So they had the memorandum in support, has the case number. The signature block at the end has the Honorable Richard Bennett, United States District Judge. So they had to at least waited long enough to fill in the blanks before they filed it. That may have been 3 minutes later, because, again, it's electronic filing.
I got to believe that this has been in negotiation for a while. It'd be a little disingenuous just to hold it for a couple of minutes or a day when you've been negotiating this for months.
Yeah, no, this is, yeah, or longer.
Or longer, right? So, I don't know. Interesting case on a lot of different levels, but I've got some concerns about it.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things is, you know, again, the federal government is here. United States of America is enforcing federal law, mm-hmm. As to the harassment under Title VII. To me, it's interesting that, again, as you've suggested, well, you could have just entered into agreements as to, which goes on a lot. But in this case, they file a suit and then have this court, because they want the federal judge. I mean, the reason to do this is you want the federal judge to be able to enforce your agreement. And, you know, whether there's going to, you know, I mean, one of the things, if you don't do what you've agreed to, is a court can say, this is my order, and we're going to file a motion for contempt of court. And they were going to want this court to basically, the judge to be overseeing. I mean, to some degree, the court's jurisdiction will have the ability to oversee this. The other thing I thought was kind of interesting and different about this, and maybe you've seen it before, is attached to the consent decree, and again, to your point of having to work this all out, is a release of claims. And they've basically said, listen, anybody who's been a victim, if they sign this release, the county has already agreed to pay you $250,000, which – from the county's perspective, both in I think an admission or their insurer, admission of somewhat of wrongdoing, although it says, of course, this is not an admission of wrongdoing or liability.
We're just going to give you the money.
Yeah, we're just going to give you $250,000. But there has to be some concern that had they gone to trial, both in terms of the litigation expenses and the potential risk of the exposure in front of a jury, that they would not have fared well. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, the counties has to be looking at this saying, you know, this is a pretty, in a general scheme of things, this may be a pretty good monetary outlet for us, or, you know, a settlement. Mm-hmm. And again, if one of the victims wants to proceed on her own, she can do that. But my guess is that amount, many of the victims are going to accept that money, sign the release, and move on with life.
There's a political part of this that I agree with. And I think, to me, what it is, it's a political statement from the county that we agree with the U.S. attorney. This should never have happened. These women have been victimized. It should never have happened. We're the boss. We're the boss of the people who perpetrated this, and we're making a political statement by our settlement of this, and that we're agreeing to take steps to make sure it never happens again. And I agree with that political statement, but I just have some questions about the criticism of how long it took them to do what they needed to do, and then this sort of a sham controversy that, if everybody's in agreement, what exactly, where's the case or controversy?
Yeah. The other question I guess I have is this, and again, I'm not trying to diminish the wrongdoing of individual employees, but this is a question that goes hand in hand with the, is it a proper investigation or not? Mm-hmm. Is a governmental entity or any other employer legally responsible for the criminal acts of its employees?
They can be. They can be. But as a general rule, unless they're aware of it and have failed to take required steps, then no.
Right. No. That's what, again, getting back to my questions here in terms of complaint, and again, I'll have to read through it a little bit more further, but where is the evidence that the county was aware, mm-hmm, that this conduct had gone on and failed to take steps? Getting back to, you know, is 4 days our failure to take steps? Because unless they were aware of this conduct of this employee who had gone on for months or years and had failed to take the proper steps, mm-hmm, again, based on this evidence, you don't see that.
Right.
And we're focused in this case on, you know, photographs and exchanging, any employee. I mean, it doesn't, male, female, whatever, but, you know, situation where somebody's taking photographs and now we're circulating. But there's all sorts of illegal conduct that could take place in the workplace.
Absolutely. And they're not the, by the way, they're not the only fire department to be dealing with this, by the way.
Right.
This is, we've got a new generation of firefighters coming into the ranks who have a new perspective on sharing images, intimate images of current or former romantic partners and themselves in some cases. And, you know, it's there's many departments that are really struggling with this. So I think there's certainly there is some potential for the city to have some liability here, and not just from the perpetrator, because remember, this, all we know is there's a perpetrator. But unless he took all the pictures that he's got in his things, he was getting it from other people. And, you know, if one of them happened to be an officer, now we've got some knowledge that this is going on by a supervisor, which, you know, supervisor awareness of sexual harassing behavior, it, it puts the organization on notice that it's going on. So again, they didn't get into all of that. And, you know, there's potentially several people who may have some responsibility beyond the one person who was sending these anonymous requests.
And so it makes you wonder, right, what information was available and not placed in this entry. We've talked, I prosecute attorneys for ethics misconduct, and there have been a number of cases where the attorney has agreed to a violation of a code of professional conduct where we don't necessarily put in all the gory details. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm looking for somebody to admit fault and accept responsibility. And so I don't necessarily need to put in that one bit of detail. And this may be a situation where the city, county, I keep saying the city, but the county understood that there were supervisors or others responsible, maybe some folks up in higher positions that they're willing to quickly, quickly is all a relative term here to the...
Four days, actually, the same. Yeah. The police were notified the same day.
Well, what we don't know is how long the negotiations had taken place, right? Yeah. So I don't know if they said, here it is, and like, oh my God, how much do we owe? Or is it, you know, this was negotiations over a year as information was being exchanged, and there's the county at some point obviously got to the point where they're saying, we're going to admit this, we're going to take all these actions, we're going to do all this stuff, and we're going to pay money. Mm-hmm. Based on facts. And my guess is there's more out there than what is pled in this complaint that caused them to agree to a number of these steps.
Yeah. Chip, I have a feeling that this is not the last time you and I are going to be talking about firefighters and these types of images being shared back and forth.
Not only shared, but, you know, again, I've had a number of cases where firefighters have without necessarily having to exchange, where they've just posted stuff. And we've talked about before, you know, the implications of the internet. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a new generation. Again, in our day, if you were going to send out an anonymous letter, you had to type it and, you know, then, you know, say, keep a copy of your carbon paper if you did that. Or, you know, again, we didn't have the opportunity really to do stuff anonymously outside of U.S. mail system. And now between, you know, the internet and the World Wide Web that, you know, creates all sorts of interesting opportunities for exchange. And it's so quick. Things can happen so quickly. You don't get a chance to undo it often. And we've talked about this in terms of what people say. Mm-hmm. On blogs, or, you know, again, we the whole issue about First Amendment. But again, when it comes just to issues of nudity, sex, and so forth, which unless you're in a dance may not have all the First Amendment protections that we discuss over there. I think that any employee needs to be very conscious of posting anything of themselves or even worse of another employee. Because it may create some issues, you know. And again, how far that wants to go. At Fire Engineering, last in 2023, there was a female that approached Brad and me who had run into a situation with her department where her husband posted a picture of her consensual. It was to a particular group. Somebody got wind of it, and again, she got disciplined for it. And there was a lot of issues that we discussed that, you know, we had questions about what the department did, whether that was appropriate. It is a really tricky situation because, again, what rules is a person on their private life necessarily violating just because you may not agree with the particular lifestyle? But that doesn't mean that that's not potentially going to cause you some heartache as an employee. So,
well, I think we beat this one to death. So I think that's going to do it.
We always kind of close in summation. And again, we've talked about the nuances of a case and our thoughts in terms of lawyers, what the government did, et cetera. But if we're going to give one or two takeaways to either an employee or supervisor or to a you know, local government running the fire department, what do we tell them?
Well, I'm not sure what there's anything we can say to individual firefighters, because they're, you know, that first of all, they're not going to pay attention to what we say. So that's and they're going to do what they choose to do in the moment and whatever that may be. But I think from a fire service leadership perspective, you need to be prepared for these types of accusations and these types of things happening. They're happening more frequently. I've got several dozen cases that fit into this sort of fact pattern here. And I don't, by any stretch, because a lot of these are so embarrassing that they never become public. I find out about them if I'm personally involved as an attorney, or I find out about it because it's, you know, going to litigation. But I've got several dozen. I wouldn't be surprised if there's hundreds, if not approaching 1,000 cases where somebody's got an inappropriate picture and sharing it and that type of thing. So from the fire department administration perspective, be prepared. The organization should have policies and procedures that are going to prohibit and explain what is appropriate and what is not appropriate in terms of sharing. You want to think through this area here. And then I feel very passionately that fire departments need to have the ability to do some investigations internally. This is not something that every time we have a problem, we've got to go hire a law firm, which I hate to go back over what we've already gone over. But imagine if on this surfaced on June 26th, how long would it take the city to go out and contract with a law firm to do the investigation? And then how long would it take the law firm then to get up and running on the investigation? It's probably going to be 3, 4, 5 weeks before you could even make that happen. So, but I really feel strongly that fire departments need to have the internal ability to conduct investigations, understanding that we're not going to be able to conduct every investigation. There are certain things that we're going to have to bring in outsiders, but our default should not be to go outside the organization, because what's going to happen is you're going to say, we don't want to have to go through that rigmarole. We won't bother investigating. And again, I think in this situation, if we look at the perpetrator here, there were probably things that this firefighter did in the past that should have alerted us to their propensity to engage in this kind of behavior. And I think if we have the internal ability to do good investigations, we can prevent this kind of scandal from reaching the point where it did in this department. And the same thing goes for many other investigations that or of scandals that end up happening, that if we can identify it early, we can get the behavior to stop, and then we don't end up with this thing that ends up on our talk show.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that, and I think that was a great summation, is you mentioned that somebody had to have known, and again, I'll just emphasize the responsibility of supervisors. When you're aware of something going on or believe something's going on, you can't sit on it. You have to take action because, as you already said, your acts or omissions can be imputed to the city, or the municipality. Again, everybody has a responsibility either to yourself, to your fellow employees, do the right thing. I hate to say that, but that's what it is, you know, to not let bad behavior continue. So I think we're, as you said, we've called it a day, beat the dead horse. So next time we will hopefully be joined by the other half of the fire service court. As usual, it's great having the opportunity to talk to you.
Yeah, same here.
So, and I will fix my phone so you and I can communicate again. So anyways, take care. On behalf of Brad, John, Kurt, and me, have a great week, and look forward to everybody joining us again for another episode of Fire Service Corps.